Thank you for joining us for the Charity Digital podcast about Brexit and what it means for the charity sector. So in a whole sort of mist of uncertainty, the things that we do know are as follows. We know that the UK voted to leave on the 23rd of June 2016 to widespread reactions of shock, some people overjoyed, some people less so. And what's followed has been about 4 years of uncertainty, potential trade deals and a potential no deal. And where we stand right now is that there was a last minute trade deal signed on the 30th of December. We officially left on the 31st of December. And now we're going to try to have a conversation about how we can move forward, how the fallout of Brexit will impact the charity sector, what we know so far, what we don't know so far, and the sorts of things we might want to think about. Before we jump straight in, I'd like to put forward a disclaimer and just state that everything on our podcast today is personal opinion. We hope to spark conversations in this podcast about Brexit and about what it means for the charity sector. However, it is all personal opinion. If you do have any questions about anything you hear today, please do get in touch with us, with any of us at Charity Digital. I will now introduce our speakers who have very kindly volunteered to join us this afternoon. We are joined by Jeff Nuttall, the Head of Policy and Public Affairs at the Northern Ireland Council for Voluntary Action. We're joined by Nazia Hashemi, Partner and National Head of Nonprofits at Crowe UK. Karen Bradshaw, the Chief Executive of the Charity Finance Group, and Richard Sagar, the Policy Manager of the Charity Finance Group. So as we start to tackle this sort of conversation with all of its wide-ranging implications and all of the myriad things that we should try to consider and think about how the UK leaving the EU might impact on the charity sector, I would like to turn to Karen and hear from Karen a little bit about how this might impact charities.
Thanks, Ravia. I think the best starting point is to recognise that in 2016, when this decision was taken, that there was a huge risk for the charity sector that we would be left behind in the conversations that then followed, that all of the conversations would be around business and it would be framed from a perspective of trade and from an economy perspective, rather than thinking about the civil society and social aspects of it. And so there were always going to be risks that charities didn't feature in those conversations going forward, maybe because we were largely seen as a Remain-leaning voice and therefore access to the more Brexit strong voices. And as we went through the process, it lurched more and more to, kind of a more extreme version of Brexit and even lots of talk at times around a crashing out no deal, World Trade Organization or latterly called Australia style deal of exiting the European Union. So I think that as we've gone through this, the charity voice and the civil society aspects have been largely under the radar and not included as much as we'd like. And maybe that's what frames what the rest of this conversation is going to be about when we look at the detail that surrounds civil society or lack thereof.
Thank you, Karen. It's interesting you mentioned the sort of the charity voice being left behind and how it's been so much more focused on sort of businesses and the economy. And I'd like to ask the group about if there's any sort of charity elements in the trade agreement that you'd like to talk about and anything that you'd like to raise about the civil society forum, what we know so far and what might happen going forward.
Maybe if I could come in, Ravia. Just to say, I mean, I would echo Karen's point that I think there is a real risk for a charity sector being left behind. It's been very much a trade-focused conversation. And obviously the trade deal itself is very much trade-focused. But it does obviously mention something which is of key interest, which is the establishment of a civil society forum, which potentially gives a voice to civil society organisations, voluntary community organisations included. So we're very keen to see the detail of that at the moment. It's very broad, but we welcome the intention to do that. And I think maybe to redress the balance of the fact that it's been very much a trade conversation, but we as an organisation, Northern Ireland Council for Voluntary Action, have been highlighting really since the referendum, the wide range of societal issues that, that Brexit touches on. And being in Northern Ireland, we've got, you know, a few additional issues to consider, like the impact of, you know, having a land border, but in perhaps on environment, health, rights and protections, a whole range of issues. So certainly civil society forum hopefully will help, you know, address some of that balance and work through some of the issues that are, you know, beyond trade.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Jeff. I mean, one of the things that really strikes me about this is the lack of detail about what that civil society forum is going to look like and what it's going to be. And there's a danger that it just becomes a sort of a, almost a lip service towards the notion of having a civil society forum. It says that it will meet at least once a year. Well, there's not a lot that you can achieve and drive forward if you're only meeting that sort of once a year sporadically. And also, what's going to be the process for ensuring that independent organisations that give a balance and spread across the four nations are actually inputting into this discussion so that we can ensure that all the elements that are obviously affecting our work, if you like, are included, but also the things that are not quite so obvious. So the impact on our beneficiaries, where the direct impact on us is less obvious, but where we'll be picking up extra need, for example, from beneficiaries that might be in disadvantaged communities and therefore not getting the sort of support that they thought they were going to get through the UK SBF or whatever it might be.
Just to add one point to that, I'm totally in agreement with what's said already. One of the few bits of detail we do know is that as part of the representatives on this group, there'll be business and employers organisations. So it's interesting that even in you know, the civil society forum, business will still get a voice. So it does echo the points that Karen made, I think, initially as well.
Just to conclude on that from me, Rabia, I think I agree with everything that's been said. I think we've seen some tensions between government and the charity sector of late over the last couple of years, especially more recently around the campaigning voice and government and conflicts that are perceived as a result of that. So the fact that government has acknowledged and has agreed to the setup of this civil society forum, I think, is positive. But as Karen and Richard have said, making sure it just doesn't become a talking shop without any tangible outcome and benefit to the sector is the bit to watch out for.
Also, there is an incentive for the politicians to ensure that they do engage with us, because many of the areas of the country that were pro-Brexit in, you know, in terms of the numbers of people in the communities voting to leave were also the communities that delivered Boris his, you know, 80-seat majority. So there is an incentive that those organisations and communities that are within those spaces are given access to this conversation. Otherwise, in 3.5-4 years' time, when we come to a general election, we may be in a very different political landscape.
You're absolutely right, Karen. It's part of that levelling up agenda that Boris and others like to talk about so much.
Touch briefly on the specifics of the trade agreement and the impact it has on charities. It's fair to say there's very little in there which is of direct impact. I mean, civil society and charities don't get mentioned apart from in relation to the mention, but there are one or two bits and pieces to be aware of, I suppose. One is that in essence, there was not a deal for services. Goods, there was an agreement on, but for many charities, obviously, services will be of more interest, and particularly for our members in the kind of financial space, there's not really a agreement on financial services as equivalent at this point. So yeah, there has to establish what's called a structured regulatory cooperation on financial services. We don't have further information at this stage, but there'll be they'll have to set out a memorandum of understanding to be agreed at March this year. So we should get a bit more information there at that point.
I mean, maybe just to add as well, I think, you know, what's noticeable, I suppose, is what's not in the trade agreement and, you know, the loss of certain things which have been important for the charity sector. So things like the European Solidarity Corps for volunteering, which the UK has opted not to continue with and is looking at an alternative, although we're yet to see the details. The Erasmus, very successful Erasmus programme, which is, you know, millions of people over its life have benefited from cultural exchanges back and forth. But again, we're not quite sure what is going to happen there. But also I think there are a whole range of hidden transition processes going on, which go beyond 31st of December 2020. So various things have still to be decided, and the deadlines for them have still to run out. So the European, the EU settlement scheme, by which EU nationals need to apply to retain the right to stay in the UK, that the deadline for that is really the end of June. And I know there's a lot of concern amongst a range of different organisations about, I mean, we in our own organisation, we surveyed our members and discovered that about one in seven of our members had employees or volunteers from mainland Europe. We're relying on people to know about this system needing to apply. We've had people from organisations who work with older people saying, you know, the over 65s are sort of not thought about in this category, but there are many of those that need to apply and may get caught out. So that's just one example of one of the many things which is yet to be bottomed out. And, you know, when it comes down to the practicalities of just being a trading organisation, buying and selling supplies, particularly for Northern Ireland-based charities, if we want to, for example, buy supplies from a supplier in England, there's a whole set of new customs-related requirements for that, which charities are trying to work through and understand. Businesses are trying to understand. There are sort of leniency periods being applied at the moment, but we very much expect those to tighten up. So I think it's far from being settled at the end of December 2020. I think we're going to be living with working through a whole range of issues which will affect charities as well as businesses. And yet the spotlight does tend to be on businesses.
Yeah, I totally agree, Jeff. I think one of the devil in the detail kind of areas coming into this pre the deal being made, CFG were very much pushing a few areas that we thought were potentially areas of opportunity as well as risk. Things like state aid and whether we'd be relieved of the cap on state aid, procurement rules and the construct around that, whether there was an opportunity to potentially reduce red tape, the tax regime as a whole. So there were chunky areas that we potentially could shift in a way that potentially assists civil society. But when you're left with sections saying that, yes, we're going to be free of state aid, but there will be a replacement modern subsidy system and an independent procurement regime, then you start to worry about what will happen if the continuation of this lack of civil society voice within the negotiation and as those arrangements are shaping up continues. You know, if we don't get our voices heard, will we end up with a modern subsidy system that continues to fail to recognise that charities and civil society have a very different relationship with each other and with distortion of markets? And often we're working where markets have failed and therefore arguably shouldn't be subject to the same sorts of restrictions that exist under the current state aid regime.
I'll add complete agreement with the last point, but bring back slightly to a point Jeff made around the EU settlement scheme. I think based on conversations we've had with members and surveys as well, I think we echo the concerns that many of those who engage with us and speak to us and want information on this are already quite engaged, but it's those charities for whom we don't really have contact, it's hard to know if they are aware of the rules and what plans they're putting in place. I mean, from my perspective, I think it's not the major issue for the sector, in that I think it's only based on CFG's research with IPPR, we found only about 4% of the charity workforce is EEA citizens. So it won't be a huge impact, but it's clustered in certain subsectors. So particularly social work and residential care, which of course will become more and more significant. And so those are the areas we really need to focus on, I think, and ensure that charities are fully up to speed with these new rules and that any immigration system we have going forward allows flexibility and ensure that we can staff these areas.
Just to add to that, it's really interesting listening to you all sort of talk about some of these challenges, in particular with some of the settlement scheme rules, the immigration rules, and also hearing Jeff say, you know, actually there's lots of other deals yet to happen and lots of detail to come out. Last week we heard about visa-free touring for British artists, for example, and this has a consequence, for example, for touring orchestras, you know, a large number of whom are actually charities. And this is around sort of, and this seems to be a blame game between the EU and the UK government at the moment with regard to, you know, who didn't want to allow this. But this will now be quite troubling for some of the touring orchestras in terms of how they can tour within Europe. There's also all sorts of challenges now with cultural work permits, with moving their instruments around, taking professional equipment. So lots of little detail which adds to costs in a sector which is already grappling with trying to get, you know, its costs reduced to sort of match in some cases falling income. And then also some of the sort of haulage regulations will also have impact on some of the charities who do actually rely on some of that supply for some of their the things that they need to actually sort of transport across borders.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I also wonder if one of the areas that we haven't talked about much and is that sort of interplay between the COVID-19 situation, and you talked about falling income there, but we know, for example, there's still very little detail about the UK SPF, which is supposed to largely replace the EU funding. We also know that it's likely to be based on receipts and not based on allocation or award. And therefore, it sounds like it's going to be less than it was before, even before it's got out the starting block, as well as not having detail over who are the people that are going to be involved in the process of distributing those funds again. Richard was talking about there being a lack of civil society present in some of these discussions, but the presence of business in some of these discussions. And I think the same thing is a risk in relation to the UK SPF and its distribution mechanism.
Yeah, I mean, if I could just sort of come in on that and reinforce it, I think there's a big concern where we are waiting for domestic policies and programs to replace what Europe has been funding for decades. And it's not even just a case of money, it's the policy frameworks that go around these programs. So the European Social Fund, for instance, has been a very, very important source of funding for a lot of charities working with people with multiple barriers to getting into employment. The current program in Northern Ireland has helped about 77,000 people. And we still don't really know what's replacing that. The UK Shared Prosperity Fund is the thing that's supposed to, but, you know, we've been waiting several years for a consultation which didn't actually arrive. And there's still a huge amount of uncertainty. And these programs traditionally would have taken maybe a year and a half to negotiate, at least, would have run for 6 years or so and then been replaced by another one. But there's a long lead-in time. There are multi-million pound programs that are being replaced. So the uncertainty is very worrying. And, you know, having that continuity for those sort of organizations and for the people that they, you know, absolutely depend on this is absolutely crucial.
I want to repeat Jeff's point around the lack of consultation on the UK SPF. It's been many a year. We've been told it's coming in the next budget or spending review, only for there to be no information or no proper consultation. But it's on top of that, it's worth noting that there was some spending review, perhaps not enough, but about a role of pilot schemes scheduled to begin this year. Now, the concern for our perspective is we don't know if charities will play a meaningful role in those, or there's some concern that it might be used to simply subsidise existing state provision and almost make up the gap that COVID has caused to many local authorities. That was announced obviously alongside this, a levelling up fund, which will hopefully do that as well. But I think we're right to focus on not just the amount of money given, but the distribution mechanism. Now, we found out, I think, last week that Hollywood, for example, won't have a role in it. It'll be distributed centrally. So that'll be obviously of concern to devolved administrations. But from our perspective, we're really keen that sort of communities get a voice in this, and that local organisations get to feed into this process and distribute as well, rather than it just being central from Westminster.
The other sort of subsector within this that is impacted by reduced funding is the international NGOs side. And, you know, they've had access to ECHO funding and to other forms of funding from the EU. Now, some of this will still continue. They can be lead or co-leads up for anything that was previously agreed. And there are ways of working some of this out. And in fact, some of the INGOs for several years now have actually established a place of business in Europe to allow them to access those funds. But the challenge also for them is the sort of the merger and the new FCDO, the falling funds, because 0.7% of GNI, gross national income, has already diminished. So 0.7% will now be less. And the 0.5%, which is where they want to move to, will even sort of make it worse. So they've got almost a double whammy at a time when there is increasing global need on health projects as a result of COVID and other challenges that they face.
Perhaps to very quickly touch on four, I think there are a number of funds that are going to continue beyond and we're still part of. And one obviously relates to Northern Ireland, and that's the Peace Plus programme, which I understand will continue until, I think, 2027. So, and that, you know, contributes towards a kind of more, you know, prosperous society in Northern Ireland and Ireland. So some positive news that that will continue. I think also Horizon Europe and Euratom, amongst others, will continue. But yeah, aside from those small points of good news, there's more questions to be.
Maybe just to come in again on the sort of policy vacuum alongside the funding vacuum, I think one area of our sector, one subsector that you know, this will very much affect their work is environmental NGOs. For so long, our environmental protection and our land management policies have been governed by EU membership. So Common Agricultural Policy, Common Fisheries Policy has really been the thing which has guided land use alongside a whole range of policies to protect and for conservation reasons, and also things like river quality and water quality and et cetera. Really, leaving the EU creates a very big blank sheet on which to replace a whole range of policy frameworks, which also have funding programs linked to them. So it doesn't just support farmers through farm subsidies, but also a lot of environmental organizations that manage and own land, the likes of National Trust, RSPB and others, would actually draw down a lot of European money to manage land in their ownership. And the way that that's been done, a lot of their work has been about working often with farmers to try and improve biodiversity and improve water quality, etc. All of this is very much up in the air, you know, it's a pretty major task to replace these things, which have been so much part of how we have governed our land and protected our environment for so long. So I think that's probably one of the reasons why the environment sector within our sector has been one of the most active throughout this sort of Brexit debate in trying to get answers to the uncertainties around future environmental protection management.
I think the other point that worries me a little bit, Jeff, and I think you're so right to highlight the risks there, is that if the direction of travel is again dominated by economic considerations rather than holistically thinking about the environmental impacts, at the same time you get decisions over things like the licensing of pesticides that are seen to add additional shall we say strains on the environment that weren't there before. So you're absolutely right, there's a huge amount of risk here, and we've got to make sure that the economic and business voice is not the only voice that is heard.
Okay, thank you everyone. There's a very slight lull, so I've really enjoyed hearing about all of the different aspects of the massive implications of, you know, the UK leaving the EU and how that's going to affect the charity sector, how it's already affecting the charity sector. And I just wanted to ask something about a couple of particular specific things. And I wanted to ask all of you about your views and your thoughts on these. I'd like to ask a little bit about the impact of the UK leaving the EU and how that might affect data protection and data transfer. That's quite a specific thing. I think a lot of charities are going to come up against that. Ourselves, you know, when we're speaking to sort of clients and customers, it's something we're always sort of mindful of. And before I open the floor, just one other thing I'd like to ask a little bit about is the impact that leaving the UK, the impact that leaving the EU might have on the EU VAT regime and what that sort of might mean for charities. So off you go.
Well, just on the issue of data transfer, I think, I mean, one of the major issues is that charities, like other organisations that will need to access data held in the EU, will no longer be covered under the current rules as an EU member. So this can affect charities even if they have no actual presence in the EU, but their data is held on servers in the EU. So in our case in Northern Ireland, there may well be organisations that just through the way they've organised their IT systems have data held perhaps in servers in Dublin. Although I don't think it's exclusively Northern Ireland, there may well be many in GB who also have data held in servers in Dublin and other parts of the EU. And there's a little bit of uncertainty. There's a little bit of an extended transition period of indeterminate length, depending on a number of factors as to exactly how this will bottom out, but it will essentially require a number of measures to be taken in order that that data can still be legally transferred, because unless those measures are taken, it will be illegal to actually access that. And, you know, in our context, there are charities that are organised on an all Ireland, Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland basis, who, you know, probably even more often will be moving data between the two jurisdictions. So again, it's an area of concern. It's an area where people are looking for clarity. We are actually working with the Information Commissioner's Office to organise an event on this next month. But it's an area of concern.
Yeah, that's something slight to that, is that when government and representatives from have spoken to our members in the wider charity sector, it is one of the four big areas they're focused on, alongside importing and exporting goods, funding, and also the settlement scheme. But I think less awareness of this amongst the charity sector. So it's something I think we need to, both as membership organisations and as, you know, organisations, try and increase. One point picking on what Jeff said is that the Trade and Cooperation Agreement does include a bridging mechanism that allows the continued free flow of data for, I think it's up to 6 months until these agreements have come into place that Jeff spoke about. But the government's recommending as a precaution that during this bridging mechanism that we should work with organisations across, you know, the EU, EEA, alternative transfer mechanisms to try and safeguard in that during that period of time. But as Jeff has rightly pointed out, a lot still needs to be determined, and a lot of that will be very relevant to many of them.
Yeah, and if I can add that this is one area where the DCMS, the department that is responsible for civil society, did issue some data or some guidance around data, I should say. And what they recommend is that you check your organisation's compliance with the GDPR, understand your flows of personal data. If your organisation receives personal data from a business or organisation in the EEA, contact them to put in place a standard contract clause, and consult guidance issued by the Information Commissioner's Office, as Jeff had referenced. And there is actually an interactive toolkit that is available on the ICO's website for people that are wanting to look more into this particular area and how it's affected by our departure from the EU.
I think you've all covered the GDPR aspect, so maybe I'll jump on and just talk about the VAT element of your question, Rabia. Generally, Brexit with regard to VAT will impact a few charities because at the moment, and I think Jeff mentioned this before, it's a goods-driven problem. So there will be a lot of some administrative work and some hassle for charities, just like all the other businesses that we hear on the sort of nightly news, if you like. But it's important, nevertheless, for charities to understand the changes to avoid any delay in financial costs or exposure. There's really about six elements that charities need to think about over the next 6 months. The first one is to obtain an EORI number. So that's the Economic Operators Registration and Identification Number. Without that, the charity could have increased costs and delays to goods being released. The other one is if you your charity is registered for MOS in the UK, and MOS is with regard to the supply of electronic broadcasting and telecommunication services. If you are registered for MOS in the UK, you need to register in another EU country, as UK MOS is no longer available. The third one is to consider the supply of goods to private customers in the UK. So that's business to customer B2C. And again, there are some specific areas in relation to this. I'm not going to go into detail, but for the first 6 months, so up to June 2021, goods sent from the UK to private customers in the EU will be zero rated exports if the charity's terms of supply give customer responsibility for any taxes. Alternatively, the UK business can choose to register for VAT in each of the EU countries, and that will be, as you can imagine, quite administratively burdensome. And then the other option is to hold stock in a single EU country and operate from that EU country. After the 30th of June, the EU has removed the distance selling thresholds and will be introducing an importer's one-stop shop, an IOS, I think. The fourth and fifth elements are in relation to reverse charges for services received and reverse charges on EU import of goods. And in terms of cost, there will be no change to these. But with regard to the reverse charging on some EU imports, there's a change. So the consignment value is less than 150 euros and you'll be required to account for reverse charge, hence the thing about the administrative burden. And the final one, which is a bit of good news, is the EC sales lists are no longer required except from GB to Northern Ireland. So that's a quick canter through the VAT elements of that, Rabia.
Yeah, and if I can just sort of throw in the policy, broader policy piece around, you know, kind of where we can go. I remember in many, many conversations that CFG had had with various ministers pre the referendum, often the EU's position was advanced as the reasons why we couldn't tackle things like irrecoverable VAT burden on charities. And therefore, when the referendum result came the way that it did, we've been pressing ever since as part of our responses to government that we should be tackling this issue around charities and irrecoverable VAT. And so therefore, there is a policy opportunity for us to press that home so that the playing field is more level for charities and civil society organisations and they're not impeded in the way that they currently are. And that's something that I think is really, really necessary at a time when we have less and less money available to us.
Yeah, no, I wholeheartedly agree with that point. And that it's quite timely, really, because I think London Economics have done an analysis in the last, late last year it would have been, that it's actually the cost of a recoverable VAT to the charity sector is actually more than we previously thought. It now stands at about 1.8 billion, which is, bear in mind that the entirety of the UK SBF we're talking about for charities would be in the region of half a billion. You can see how significant that is. And so CFG, amongst a number of organisations, and most notably Charity Tax Group, have called for, as a kind of opening gambit on this issue, a special rate of VAT following our departure to try and reduce, for charities rather, to try and reduce the amount of irrecoverable VAT for the sector. So, I mean, our long-term goal is to get that down to zero, of course, but in the meantime, there's many steps along the way. So the more we can reduce that, the more money there will be for the sector and most importantly for beneficiaries.
Thank you, everyone. I just wanted to mention that we've covered a lot of very interesting ground, lots of general sort of overview information, a lot of very keen specifics that I think myself and other charities going forward are going to be wanting to think about, and you will find it's quite an interesting place to start. As we continue, I just wanted to ask, are there any other points that you would like to raise during this discussion?
For me, I guess the big issue, the kind of the elephant in the room, is that policy narrative. It's the role that civil society plays within society that is at the heart of all of the things that we've talked about. These are all detailed areas that could impact us in positive or negative ways. And I think the dice is very much weighted towards business. So what we end up with is often policies being set by the economic and business imperative that then have unintended consequences for civil society in ways that if we'd been involved in the conversation up front, we could have avoided by hardwiring in something that took account of the special circumstances that we often operate within. As I said, you know, earlier, we don't operate often in a marketplace. We're often operating where the market has failed. And therefore, a lot of these mechanisms that are put in either to counter fraud or to ensure that you don't distort markets are put in with business and the economy in mind, rather than thinking about civil society and the way in which charities feed into those different spaces. So there's that element. And the other element that we have alluded to a little bit is around these disadvantaged communities, because often the fallout from things like closing the coal mining industry or the fallout of steel contracting was picked up by an EU initiative that then would come in and support the re-emergence of civil society space and social reconstruction, if I can put it that way. And if we don't see some of that stuff re-emerging post-Brexit, then we are going to end up with disadvantaged communities becoming even more disadvantaged as a result of our exit from the EU.
I think maybe the other thing I was going to mention was the different ways in which this may affect charities in different parts of the UK, because there are kind of large areas of sort of policy that have been largely dealt with within the devolved countries of the UK and also within the regions of England. So large programmes targeted at, you know, ex-industrial areas of England, or, you know, programmes that have targeted on particular needs in, say, rural development programme for Northern Ireland and other places. There's a complex architecture of policies which have been developed quite a lot directly with European Commission officials by different parts of the UK. And with Brexit, a whole range of policy areas have essentially come back from Europe. But the way in which they go back out to the devolved administrations is something which is sort of in flux and is subject to a lot of discussion. There's been a lot of discussion on so-called UK frameworks for different areas. And again, it goes back to things like, you know, environment in particular, or environmental organizations are very sort of concerned to see what that looks like, because we've had things like the European Water Framework Directive has been the primary way in which we've kept our rivers clean and healthy for wildlife. And rivers don't respect borders, they flow across them. And so, you know, we've you know, the UK frameworks initially were apparently not identifying water management as something that required a new framework, which seems perplexing to a lot of environmental organisations. So there are a lot of areas, I think, still to be worked through in how does UK policy get reframed post-Brexit? And it's got the added complication, obviously, for someone like Northern Ireland, which is got a land border with an EU state, which is still applying EU policy. So we've had river basin management plans for managing a river that flows from the Republic into Northern Ireland. If you're applying different systems, and then there's very different results from trying to manage and keep clean those sort of things. So I think that's a whole area that is exercising different parts of our sector. And again, you know, the rights and protections that protect different sections of society, whether it's gender protections, whether it's disability legislation, the more that the UK diverges from that, and also the different administrations within the UK may diverge from each other, that creates a very complex picture, which a lot of our members and our sector organisations are having to negotiate.
Yeah, if I could build on that, Jeff, I think one of the issues that we've kind of alluded to on a number of the answers is around that increase in red tape. There's a danger that we could end up with a great deal of additional bureaucracy that is built in, either because of cross-border activity or inter-country activity. There is one other rights that popped into my mind where you were speaking, and that was around the asylum rights as well, because although it's harder to return asylum seekers to other countries of origin, it's also, I think, my reading of it, going to be harder for the right to family life to be pursued, because you won't be able to bring necessarily family members to join you as an asylum seeker in the UK.
I mean, perhaps just making a point related to that, I think it's a broader one around, we've heard many times from those who advocate for Brexit that we're leaving the European Union, not Europe. And I hope that sentiment is you know, stuck, you know, that continues, because I think, be it climate change, the environment, asylum, these are international and or international development. These are issues that need cross-border cooperation. And so it's really important that that continues in whatever guise going forward as well.
I mean, just to kind of build on that slightly, that perhaps we're sort of at the extreme end of that, having the land border where, you know, for instance, Women's Aid, one of our member organisations, was flagging the issues about having access to things like refuges and emergency services, the nearest one of which might be across the border. It is a live issue which organisations like Women's Aid are trying to deal with. And, you know, that's the kind of reality on the ground of trying to manage two different systems, particularly in a context like our own, where previously you wouldn't have seen any barrier to that at all.
Just to add to what everyone has said, from slightly a different viewpoint, I think for me, as someone who's worked in this sector and worked with the sector for the last 25 years, what I see is a broad, varied, well-organized, well-run, vibrant sector full of passionate people. And today you've been hearing from Jeff, Karen and Richard and their knowledge on this. And I think it's a sector to be proud of. Sometimes I think we forget about the combined effect of our joined voices. And in terms of actually leveraging off that, Karen and others have been championing hashtag Nevermore Needed, which has been spot on for this moment in time. And I think hashtag Nevermore Needed, we need to keep emphasising that and keep, first of all, making sure that government listens to the unique challenges for charities and their importance in the discourse of civil society, but also, as Jeff, Karen and Richard have said, on other issues which will be across EU, like environmental, asylum, things like that. So I think we just need to keep the pressure up and make sure that the voice of the sector continues to be heard.
Thank you so much, Nazia, for your kind words. And I'd like to thank all of our contributors today, Nazia, Karen, Jeff and Richard. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon and contributing your expertise and your valuable insights. I feel like I've learned just so much by listening, and I've sort of made mental notes on things I want to, you know, kind of Google or look up and read more up about. And I'm sure that will be the same for our listeners. Once again, thank you all for joining us. I'd like to thank everyone who's tuned in to listen to us today as well. This is an ongoing situation. The relationship, as we've heard today, between sort of government and charities and civil society is so sort of complex and interwoven with sort of business concerns and economic realities and
ambitions. So as we move forward, I'd like to state to our sort of listeners, and hopefully our speakers could come back to us about this as well, if there's another, you know, related topic you'd like to talk about, please get in touch with our team here at Charity Digital, and we will try to get some more information and research out there for you. I'd like to give you some applause, but I don't have the ability to do that by myself in the office today. So I'm going to repeat my initial thank yous. As I said earlier, and as all of our speakers have shared with us in great detail, because Brexit is such an ongoing, complex, multi-layered thing, there is going to be more information coming out. As Richard, I think you mentioned, some policy is due to be announced in the run-up to March. So I'd like to ask all of our listeners, you can keep up to date, you can refer to the content put out by Charity Digital, government websites, government comms, government social media. The organisations that our speakers have joined us from today are other very great places to kind of start. And I, you know, information is our best tool. I think at the moment, information is the best resource we can lean on. So let's just try and get out there and get as much information as we can from all the different aspects of this going forward. Okay, thank you, everyone. That was Charity Digital covering Brexit in this podcast. Thank you all.
Thanks, Rabia.
Thank you.